My name is Nick Sievert. I'm the founder and CEO of JengoFX. I started the company about 7 years ago, and I've been working in games in general for about 15 years. I started out modding a long time ago, and so I just count that in my timeline. Currently based in Austin, Texas, but I'm originally from South Carolina, and found my love for visual effects after Valve released their visual effects toolkit for Half-Life 2 Episode 2 in 2007. And ever since then, I've pursued greatness in visual effects.
So how did it start with you that you wanted to develop your own VFX software? Did it come from your own kind of needs that you didn't see something available, or, you know, maybe you started experimenting? Because usually when I look at stuff like this, it starts with hardcore engineering work, and people are doing, you know, papers for SIGGRAPH, and after that, slowly something builds up. What was your kind of journey there?
Yeah, so I believe in 2012, I started using a different software that was a plugin for 3ds Max at the time, and I think they're still around, but regardless, I had noticed that the software was really slow. It was taking like 24 hours or more to generate fire, smoke, and explosions. And I was working on a really popular mod at the time called No More Room in Hell. And we were one of the first 10 games greenlit on Steam back when Steam had the greenlight program. And so I was doing visual effects for that and wanted to start making my own textures, and quickly found out that it was going to be pretty much impossible with the computer that I had. And, you know, with the limitations that, you know, I was running into with the software. And I was just thinking, I'm like, well, this was naive, but I was like, well, if Valve's particle editor for Half-Life can run so fast, why can't this? And that was just kind of the start to my journey. And then after that, a couple years later, you know, we were working on No More Room in Hell 2, and that's still in development today. And I kind of left the modding scene and went off to just go learn, I would just call it general business stuff. And, you know, was reading about entrepreneurship and being a part of startups and everything. And then after a few years of that, I figured I was ready to start JengoFX and really try my hand at making a serious product for fluid simulations.
I'm super interested to learn about, you mentioned that you started with the kind of like business literature and learning more about, you know, how to actually run it. How did you analyze this market? Did you feel like this is enough, there's enough potential for this tool, or like what were like the main things that you saw that this is a, could be a, like a profitable thing?
Yeah, I think the main thing is I felt like I knew just in my gut that it was going to work. I didn't really have any data or anything to back it up, but I saw what other companies were doing, and I just presumed how much money they were making. And I was like, well, if I could cut the time from, you know, 12 or 24 hours for the simulation and the renderer, and save artists an immense amount of time and just have it be instantaneous, I don't see why I couldn't make all the money in the world for this. And I felt like it was a huge problem to solve. And so, you know, eventually I brought on the right team to help me solve those things. Some of the bigger hardcore challenges, and luckily we were able to solve it, and my ideas more or less worked, and so it was awesome.
Let's talk a little bit about how your software helps solve like the biggest pain points of the developers currently, because when you look at it, you know, development teams currently, is like, if it's a big project, it's like thousands of people, you know, in different countries all over. It's incredibly expensive. The budgets for games like, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn or something like that is like $100 million and so on. And of course, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure cost-wise. There's a lot of pressure time-wise. How do kind of like VFX artists feel in this situation? Like, and how can they solve some of those, like resolve some of those pressures by using the software that you're building?
The key thing that we were solving for artists was that it was going to be the first tool that was really truly built for visual effects artists in games. Everybody else in games on the art department, they have tools that are kind of built for them. You know, you've got 3D modeling tools and things like Substance Designer that help you generate materials. And, you know, there's ZBrush, which is really, really awesome. And it works for both film and games, really awesomely and all this other stuff. And I was just thinking, I'm like, well, why don't we have tools? We're just stuck with Photoshop or whatever, or some film fluid solver that's mostly for film. And then we really hack it together and we have this like 10-step process to get it, flipbooks and stuff like that ready for games. And it's just so much pain. I'm like, why can't we just do that all in one major tool? And so I think that's the first major piece is that ImperGen, it immediately is ready to export any game data you would probably ever want for fluid simulations for your particles and stuff. And then I think the second thing is just the ease of use and the iteration speed. So you can, export something from ImperGen and then re-import it into Unreal in like 2 seconds or whatever, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and refresh your textures constantly to make sure that, they're what you want inside of Unreal or Unity or whatever it happens to be, whatever engine you're using. And it just works. And so it's awesome. And I think that's why we're used in, I believe, probably over 400 studios right now, which is just amazing that we've got that much reach.
So tell me a little bit about how it works, because when you're saying flipbooks, I can go years into the past and probably people were still using flipbooks at the time, because it's such a format that had been developed, I think, out of necessity in a lot of ways back then. And now that we have software that is and also hardware that's a little bit more powerful and so on, why is it still kind of like in that format? Why don't we have kind of like more powerful? Because you think about simulations of water, simulations of explosion stuff, and it's robust, incredible. Like there's like thousands of particles and so blowing up, and it does look incredible in a lot of ways. And in demo reels and people on AV level are building like incredible stuff, including with a lot of stuff built by Jenga, by the way. And I'm wondering, like, what's your take on it? How do you kind of like combine this incredible, powerful simulations, but the output is this flipbook? Do you think that it might change in the future? Like, what's your rationale for kind of like using this workflow?
Yeah. So right now, the rationale is that volumetrics being simulated and rendered at the same time just won't fit in your typical video games visual effects budget. I feel like, more so now with, say, like, the latest Horizon game, I believe either Forbidden West or Zero Dawn, I can't remember which one is the newest one, but they have like these really nice volumetric clouds and like this like big rotating storm and all kind of stuff, and it's really amazing technology. And so, we can do the volumetric portion. It's still the simulation that is really quite difficult, I think. And mainly that's because I believe the main budget for most games is about 2 milliseconds, between 2 and 3 milliseconds for visual effects. And say an ImperGen simulation, which is extremely optimized, it still takes, say 8, 10, 12 milliseconds just to run what the quality that we're getting. And so I do think that there is going to be an opening for this kind of stuff within the next console generation or two, where I finally think the hardware will be powerful enough. Our algorithms will be, even more optimized with sparse technology so that you're not computing an entire bounding box, but you're computing just what you need and things like that. So I really think that volumetrics are like the time for it is now, and then we'll eventually add the simulations to it later. And so we can probably bake out to volumetric formats, but as per flipbooks, it's just a very cheap option, and you can have many of them on screen, and it costs almost nothing to run them, and you can reuse them kind of infinitely throughout all kinds of different effects. And we've come up with many different tricks over the years, our beloved technical artists and stuff like that in other studios and whatnot, where they've kind of devised plans to have like bake the volumetric lighting into something called a 6-point light map, and then you can pull like the sun from your game and light the 2D sprite as if it were 3D, and that really sells the effect. And I feel like most players and stuff like that can't really tell that it's not 3D once you've got a bunch of these things on screen. And so visual effects is all about how much fakery can we get away with? And I think that flipbooks have really stood the test of time and have continually evolved just as well as everything else in games. And so it gets to the point where, say with Ninja Theory, they had this big troll that was on fire and it used Embergen, but they used a depth pass that we exported from Embergen, and it was able to blend in 3D space with the troll. And so from a certain camera angle, the fire looked completely volumetric, but once again, it was still just a 2D flipbook. And so I really think that the technology for it has kept up good enough to where it doesn't really matter, I don't think.
I think it's, you mentioned that it's still kind of like a lot of fakery in games in terms of visual effects. And it is a lot of smoke and mirrors. Like if you dissect something, it looks very simple, but on some of the tools still seem simple. Some of them are like crazy, like the shader for liquid and in a bottle for Half-Life, like the latest one, the Alex. That's some crazy stuff. But I wanted to kind of talk a little bit more about the business aspect of it. So you mentioned that you kind of started it when you were working at Funcom, you were having your regular work, and then suddenly started building up the tool and so on. And I'm wondering how did you approach your kind of like go to market? Like, what is the way that these tools are usually sold to studios?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever thought modern video games should be more interesting? At The Gaming Blender, we take randomized genres, mechanics, and make a new game every episode.
I've added permadeath.
We have a survival game of a hardcore simulation, which could be House Flipper, and with the permadeath of XCOM, then that all has to be an action adventure.
Yes.
Ooh, dear.
Yes.
And sometimes it doesn't quite work.
And you have a construction off over the course of the narrative.
A construction off? The way we can do this is that we ditch your idea entirely.
Entirely.
Check out The Gaming Blender on all your favorite podcast platforms now.
Originally, whenever we started, I had built a different tool called Vector Agent, and it was to generate vector fields for games. And that was kind of my first intro to how am I going to sell software? How are we going to make it? How are we going to distribute it? And just figure everything out before we do the big product, which it was Embergen at the time. And so now our big product is like Liquigen, and we're kind of aiming towards that and whatnot, but that's a different story. But anyway, so, I felt like I want to build a big email list, because at the time I did not know anyone throughout all the years that I was modding and things like that. I was kind of concentrated in what they call like the source community. So, the Half-Life community and modding and all that stuff. And I only knew one or two other people who actually knew how to use the particle editor. So it was kind of, if you knew it, you were like this person who knew Blackmagic, and everybody wanted you or one of the other two people to work on their mod. So it's like, we have like a bunch of credits on our, on different mods, because we were the only people who could do it. And, we loved it and wanted to work as much as we could on it and learn more things. But regardless, to go to market, I really just started hitting up like the real-time VFX forums and posting on LinkedIn and connecting with a bunch of effects artists. And once it was time or close to releasing Embergen, we started getting on calls with studios and like, hey, we're building this tool. We need a bit of guidance and direction. Like, what do you want? And so we would just kind of show what we had, and, people's jaws would be on the floor because they'd never seen anything like it. And then they'd just go, hey, we want this, 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 and this. Like, this is our wish list. And, we probably did, I would say maybe 10 or 15 calls kind of at the beginning with some big studios, who were working on mainly like some of my favorite titles or, some of the team's favorite titles. And so we started there since we were passionate about those games and reached out to those studios. And they were, you know, happy enough to get on a call for, you know, 30 or 40 minutes and just see what was coming up. And some studios were like, hey, we'll pre-order it now. And that was kind of like a big thing to be like, hey, you know, I really think that this is going to work. And then we released in November 2019. And surprisingly, we ended up releasing because we were about to run out of money. And so we had gone to like a conference and had paid for all the tickets, and Vector Ragen sales weren't working out hardly at all. Like, they had gone to zero after I quit my job. And I was like, man, I'm like, we got to do something. We need a Hail Mary. And I'm like, well, why don't we just, you know, add the licensing stuff to Embergen and sell it as is. And by that time, we had built up an email list of about 6,000 people, I believe. And that was just through YouTube videos and teasers and word of mouth and Twitter. Twitter was a huge one, actually, building up that following. And so, yeah, we just sent out an email. Hey, Embergen is out, you know, buy it now, you know, as is. And we sold quite a lot of copies, and, you know, the feedback was amazing, and we've been developing on that ever since. And so that was kind of our go-to-market strategy. I really felt like it was going to work. I built an email list and then marketed the crap out of it.
Well, when the money ran out, just release stuff. I think it's a great advice to any any kind of startup founder.
We were definitely pre-MVP. I'm like, we still have like 6 months to go before like I'm comfortable releasing this. But I'm like, if we want to survive,
you know,
yeah.
I don't know if you're comfortable talking about this, but did you get a lot of funding? Did you do like Series A, Series B, or stuff like that? Or were you just kind of like using friends and family money, your own savings?
I maxed out my own credit cards for this, but I've never taken any money from family or friends, or I've never raised money. It was all just funded by me.
And now it's basically entirely funded through sales of the product.
And now we're entirely funded by sales. And we have, I believe, 22 employees now.
That's amazing. And it's such a good place to be, I think, psychologically. That you're kind of...
It is, definitely. And it's really nice to know that like this is something that like we've built, and it's not just me. Yeah. I mean, there's so many people on our team. Everybody contributes equally to build this. And so I'm kind of the face of it, but the team is really what holds us all together and creates the amazing products.
You were saying that you did what you could. You saw a pain point, you created a solution, and then you started basically doing demos to people. Started gathering feedback. And I immediately remember the story. We did an interview with Algorithmic back in the day when they were still Algorithmic. And they said that they did a very similar thing, and they did have some failures before. But what they did when they were actually doing Substance Designer, they went to, I think it was Naughty Dog or some other big clients, and they said, okay, we're going to give you the software, and we're just going to do like whatever feature you want. You just to tell us kind of like what you need. And it worked out very well because they had this client that kind of like created the feature list basically for their software. And my question for you is like, do you feel like it's important to have this early feedback from clients to have an understanding how they're using the software, you know, what do they need from this tool and so on? And how did you kind of like maybe gather that feedback? Like what was the process with Embergen?
Yeah, so back in the early days of Embergen, I actually went to GDC, and this was in 2019, and I met a guy named Nikita, and he was working at 4A Games, which was the Metro series is one of my favorite series ever, you know, right after Half-Life. And so I met him, and I was like, man, like the visual effects are amazing in Metro, and I can't believe, you know, that you guys are pulling this stuff off. I would like to give your studio Embergen before anybody else has it, and just give me as much feedback as you can. And then hopefully for me, the way I win is just Embergen is used in Metro Exodus. And so it did get used in Metro Exodus, and they let us, you know, use some video and stuff like that. But, you know, some of the feedback was instrumental. And then we also had a QA testers channel on our Discord server where we would invite, industry people into the Discord, and whenever they had time, they would test it and give us feedback, and we kind of, built up on that, and that was kind of our way of collecting feedback, was mainly through Discord.
But did it help in the end? Did you find it useful to get this early into the real game?
Absolutely, because it kind of gave us direction. I'd say for the most part, we probably had it right 80% of the time, but it was that additional 20% where they're like, actually, we don't do this anymore in games, or, we do it this way now, or this is the data type we're really looking for, or, your normal maps weren't normalized properly, or whatever it happens to be. And it's like, oh, okay, so this is how your engine works, or whatever it happens to be. And so we were able to get a lot of testing and feedback, and I'd say it was extremely important, and it helped out a lot.
So once you have this feedback, you have the software, and you're maxing out or your credit card, you start thinking, okay, let's start selling. And I'm sure one of the questions you had in mind was, what about the pricing? How do I price this product? And when you look at the market, it's such a kind of like you're basically putting a product that needs to compete with a bunch of corporations, right? Like, let's say Autodesk or Adobe, and they have just a bunch of economists who are just sitting there and figuring out very smart pricing and strategies and how to do subscriptions and licensing and all that stuff. How did you approach it? Like, did you run a survey asking for pricing? Did you do some kind of like an auction? Sometimes people do that. Or did you look at the competitor pricing and kind of trying to figure out, or was it cost-based, Nick, where you kind of like you're figuring out, okay, how much money did I actually spend on this thing, and how much money do I need to make sure that it runs and I'm profitable, I don't ask for more money? Like, what was your price? Super interesting to learn. We don't often have an opportunity to look kind of like at that thinking.
Yeah, so I think that the first part to get right was just licensing. Like, what were we going to offer for any given price? And so we wanted to make sure that it was a perpetual license, or rather, I think permanent is the better term, because you can buy and then you get 12 months updates and they stop, but you own that last updated version of the software forever. Like, you will never take it away from you. And then you can come and buy maintenance at any year in the future. It doesn't matter how many years have passed, you can buy maintenance and then you immediately have the next version. And so we wanted to make sure that we did that first and foremost. And then we broke it up into three tiers. We said, okay, well, we're going to have indie/hobby. And then we're going to have, which is revenue under $1 million. And then we're going to have studio, which is, 1 million to $100 million. And then if you make over $100 million or you have funding over $100 million or whatever, that's going to be enterprise and you have to contact us, basically. And so we structured it like that. And then we kind of figured out, I was like, well, let's look at all the different competitors and everything else. And, the competing tools, it was like, $900 for this, or $800 for this, or $700. I'm like, this is just ridiculous. I'm like, as an indie person maxing out my credit cards on this business, I'm like, I could never afford $700 or $800 for this thing. And it's just kind of ridiculous. And so I was like, well, why don't we price it, pretty low, but still, if we can sell the numbers, I feel like it'll make sense. And it's really the studios and enterprises that are going to be paying truly for the software. And that's where most of our money is going to come from. But we want to make sure that we help the indie person, because they're making a small game or whatever. And eventually, if they do have a big success, then they'll need to buy a studio license. So we'll get the money eventually. And so kind of went that way. And I was just like, well, let's do like $200 or $300. And throughout the years, we've kind of like slowly raised our pricing as we've learned what our operation costs are and what the units that we sell each month are and things like that. And it's pretty consistent and, statistical at this point, where we kind of figure out, what's the right pricing point. And we also wanted to make sure that we had like a monthly option. And I know that a lot of people really hate subscriptions, but originally it was 12 months. You could pay for 12 months and then get a permanent license. Now it's 18 months because we had to raise the pricing a little bit due to inflation and stuff. But overall, it seems to be working really well. And mainly, I'd say what we did is, I think we took like 2 months and just made spreadsheets of a bunch of different projections and kind of what we thought we could do and how much money we thought, you know, an individual person would be willing to spend, and kind of take the value of what we thought, you know, they were going to be getting from it. Because we realized that, you know, for a game, say if you're an indie person, you know, maybe you need 10 or 20 really high quality flipbooks or something. And, you know, we're like, is that worth $500? Probably not. You know, it's probably worth more like $200 or $300. And you're going to have the fun that you want creating that versus getting it from a marketplace. And then additionally, kind of lost my train of thought here. Yeah. Anyway, that's about it on the pricing. That's all I can think about for it.
I think one of the why it's successful, because you knew the market so well. It's kind of like, it's not that you went there from kind of like a C-level office and saying, okay, no, we're going to price it this much and so on. But you really understood kind of like, how much is this actually worth to, like, if I were sitting and building a game myself. And we know a lot of those stories where people are, you know, driving a very old car, they live with, you know, roommates, or like, it's not really a rich life, let's say, right? And then you need to do something, and a lot of people would just never buy something like that. It's like $600. Even that could be like a no-go situation, right? So you need to really place it in that interesting point. And also, I think what is super smart about this is it's like a bottom-up strategy. Yes, enterprises, definitely. I'm sure that they are like the, monetary-wise, they are like the biggest kind of investors, I guess, the buyers, right? But at the same time, when people buy this inexpensive license, they learn the software. And then maybe they will go to like a big company, you know, start suggesting, okay, I've been using this at home and or in my other job or something. It's very fast, it's lovely, and kind of like you get these evangelists basically for a very small fee, and then they start selling to enterprises.
And we actually give free licenses to universities. So if they're, you know, an accredited university, and even in some rare cases, we'll give like an online school that's, you know, really that really puts out good content, we'll give them free licenses for their students and stuff like that, for at least on-site or whatever it happens to be. And that works out really well for those students who are now learning Embergen, and they're going to take that into the industry and say, hey, what I learned on was Embergen. And then they tell their studio, hey, we need more licenses, or I want to buy this, or, you know, can we get this or get the budget? And then that ends up paying dividends in the future. And I remember one other thing that I was thinking of, and I think that this is my train of thought that I lost, was as part of the pricing as well, it's such a good sale and a good deal, because everything else, literally every other tool, is a plug-in for something else that costs $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, right? And that's already hurting the indie person. And I'm like, well, I'm going to make it standalone, because we will have full control over everything that we want to do. And I think that's so important versus relying on somebody else who can jack their prices up, and then maybe our thing is cheap. But they're like, well, now the thing that it actually goes in is like $5,000 because of inflation or whatever. And now we just can't use your product because it's a plug-in. So ultimately, I'm all about controlling my own destiny. And so that's why we went standalone as well. And it really makes it so that we can bring the pricing down without having to worry about what somebody else is doing.
Nick, and I also, there is another point I think that is super important for the people who are listening, is that you did a perpetual license. And, you know, everyone hates subscriptions, because if you look at a 3D artist, they have to pay so much. It's like thousands of dollars, because it's not just about you know, Photoshop anymore, right? It's you need to do Maya, you need to do all those other tools. And this is one of the kind of like why stuff like Blender is popular. You know, it's not even because people get it for free, it's not that. It's just like, it's, you know, you just download it and you use it for a long period of time. You don't pay anything on top of it, right? And having this license that is perpetual, and I think one of the reasons why you were able to do it is because you didn't have any external funding. Because I couldn't imagine a VC who would go and say a perpetual license is such a good idea they would never say something like that. They would go subscription full scale and kind of like squeeze every cent out of it. And then you had this wonderful opportunity. I think it's a very nice situation to be overall.
It is a nice situation to be in. And I think that, you know, overall, it ends up paying dividends where, you know, it's nice whenever I watch like a review video or something like that on YouTube, or I'm watching a stream and somebody's using Embergen and somebody will just casually mention, oh, by the way, their license is permanent, right? And, you know, they're one of the few companies that actually, you know, don't, you know, completely destroy our wallets or whatever it happens to be. And, or, you know, the money for me, maybe it is a bit high because I live in a country that, you know, my currency isn't strong, but man, it's so worth it because now I own it forever or whatever it happens to be. And like, that makes me feel good as a person where I'm like, okay, like I'm actually doing these people a really solid thing. And, you know, it's nice to have like emails where like, hey, you know, I didn't have much money and I invested in Embergen and now I have a really high paying job as a visual effects artist, you know, because your software is literally what got me the job because they've required it for the job opening and not many people knew it at the time or whatever it happens to be. And so those are really good to know that like we're providing job opportunities and things like that for the people who know the software too, since it's kind of at this point, I would say becoming more and more of an industry standard for visual effects artists.
So talking about the standard, tell us a little bit more, what are you going to develop in the plans? Like, what's your roadmap looking like? What are the next things that you're concentrating on? What are like the next kind of like bricks that you're going to put at the foundation of this amazing company you're building?
Yeah, so I think that we want to expand outside of visual effects in general. I really think that's still like our core market and that's like our core love and just what the team loves and what I love and all this other stuff. But, you know, before I was a visual effects artist, I was a level designer, right? And I'm like, man, I can just think back and I'm like, just using Unreal or Unity or whatever today, I'm like, why are these problems not solved? Why 20 years later do we still have the same level design problems or the same, you know, environment modeling problems or whatever it happens to be? And it's once again, everyone is using tools built for film, but they're using it, you know, for games like 3ds Max or Maya or whatever it happens to be. I'm like, this is not a good workflow. I'm sure many people will say, but once you learn it, it's easy and all this stuff. Well, I tried to learn for a long time and I just couldn't get it right. And I tried really hard and, you know, buying back then it was like digital tutor tutorials and all this stuff. And I just couldn't grasp it. And it just didn't fit my own model of the world of what I think software should be. And so we kind of want to tackle that stuff. And I think our first entry to that is going to be GeoGen, which is our you know, upcoming real-time terrain editor. And it's really going to be built from the ground up, you know, for games specifically. And then we also have LiquidGen, which is probably the most sought-after tool we've ever had in our lives. I can't tell you how big my email inbox is of people, you know, at studios and film studios, game studios, everything just being like, hey, we're working on XYZ massive project. We need LiquidGen now. I'm just like, well, you're going to have to hold on a little bit. And so I kind of see that that's where we're going as a company, you know, really honing in on visual effects, but kind of building up another side where it's like, how can we tackle, you know, the other pieces of game development that, you know, artists have constant problems. I remember just, you know, working in a professional setting and hearing somebody say, what the across the office, because their software had crashed for the 10th time in 10 minutes. And they're like, I can't believe I just lost this entire character I was drawing because it corrupted the whole thing on the server or whatever. I'm just like, man, what big problems? Like, how much money do studios lose because the software just isn't good? And so, you know, these types of things, I just wonder, like, can we solve it? I don't know. You know, it's something where I'm not as, you know, knowledgeable about environment art, but I hope that we can hire the teams and bring in the professional artists and things like that that do know the problems and they do know what they want and how we can solve it. And then we can solve it step by step. So we'll see where we go, but I think it's going to be a really fun journey.
It's a very interesting point you brought up, and I'm glad to hear about all the kind of like new avenues. I'm sure our listeners are going to be over the moon to kind of hear what you got in store with the, you know, the environment generation stuff. I think it's, you know, it's such a popular topic. But the situation you describe, I think it's kind of ironic. Basically, you have an industry that is relying on tools that are developed by company who doesn't really care about this market that much. Because if you think about
exactly, you know, and, you know, if you take, let's just say, some of the big A's, right? We'll call them that, right? So if you take their companies, the rate at which they care about the game industry is probably zero. I mean, I bet that it accounts for such a small portion of their revenue that it just doesn't even matter, because, you know, you've got all these like CAD programs and all that stuff and engineering and whatever, and that's where all the money is, or say consumers that are using Photoshop for editing their photos because they're photographers, and the market for that is so much bigger. And so I'm like, well, if we can come in and we can make tools that are specifically for games and build it the way that the artist wants, with the bridges the artists need and all this other stuff, and it's easy to use versus some other tools that are just god-awfully hard to learn. And they're like, yeah, it's going to take you probably 2 to 3 years to learn this. And it's like, holy crap, like, that sucks. That really sucks to me. And I'm like, what a waste of time. And of course, once you use it, then, I mean, you have the power of everything. You can do anything you want. But to me, I'm like, well, at what cost, you know, with how much stress and all this other stuff. And so I'm just thinking, you know, how can we make it easy to use, fun? Because I remember back in the day, modding was so fun. Right. And I'm trying to bring that back to software, where I don't want somebody to go, I have to open this thing again, and I know I'm just going to be so angered by it, and I just want to get out of it. But I want people to open our software and go, man, I'm so glad that it's time that I have something to do with this, because it's just a joy to use and it's so much fun and it brightens my day or whatever it happens to, or it's just so cool that I can't stop looking at it or whatever. And what we pitch studios is we say, you know, we don't know if we're going to save you money, because your artists might spend so much time playing with the software, they might not get anything done. And that's just a testament to how fun the software is. And so it really kind of, to me, brings the fun back to our jobs as game developers, and especially with kind of how the industry is these days with crunch and all this other stuff. I at least want, if I can bring some joy to their work, then I've done my job. So that's kind of my goals.
Thanks for enjoying another episode of the 80 Level Roundtable podcast. Check out upcoming episodes on the 80 Level website at 80.lv. Join our career site at 80.lv/RFP. And share our podcast with friends and on your social networks.